This is Fresh Air. My guest is psychologist Robert J. Lifton. He studied what happens to the human psyche in times of war, destruction, and mass death. Lifton has studied Hiroshima survivors, prisoners of war, and war veterans. He's analyzed the mindset of Nazi doctors. But he's perhaps best known for his work on the psychological defenses we put up to protect ourselves from the fear of nuclear war. He calls it psychic numbing, a disease that paralyzes the mind to keep us from feeling. Earlier today, he told me that this war is resulting in psychic numbing. And the numbing is partly a response to sitting in front of the TV, watching high-tech weapons take out their targets.
There's something very fascinating about seeing the Pentagon's pictures of what the weapons do. That is, to see a weapon go into an air shaft of a building is something of a miracle, as it's recorded to hit its precise target right down to the particular building and its air shaft. When one steps back a bit and realizes that this is an example of high-tech warfare and that it has all kinds of dubious human effects, including effects upon those conducting the war, then one steps back from one's initial fascination. And I go through some of those feelings, but then my main sense is one of sadness and deep concern about the extent to which we're able to conduct this technological war without really taking in very much of the human pain. And that's a grave danger in connection with this war and in connection with our future and everybody's future.
You don't want us to be removed from the human pain that war causes. Would you like to see graphic footage from battle or graphic footage from the after effects of bombing shown on television? Or do you think that that would lead to further numbing because we were just watching it on TV?
No, I think that it should be shown. I think that the impulse on the part of official bodies to restrict what's shown has to do with a concern that Americans will become too upset about the war and may not support it. But I think that in a democratic society, we should have all of the information available, all possible information available, including painful imagination, so that we can make our decisions and can respond to what's really happening rather than responding to a veil or a barrier to what's really happening. And what's really happening is that human beings are being hit by our bombs and Iraqi bombs or missiles, and that there are tragic human consequences to this war which shouldn't be kept from us.
You've written about how war experts and strategists function almost as hired anestheticians. Do you see that happening now?
Yes, sadly I do, because, you know, even though the Cold War seemed to end with glasnost and perestroika, although there are new problems, but we still have carried through Cold War attitudes to this particular confrontation. And what I mean by that is it's the Gulf War and the Gulf Crisis have been managed almost entirely by strategists. And notably absent have been people with knowledge of the area, with a broader historical view, with a broader human view, with experience in subtle diplomacy, so that every day President Bush seems to meet almost exclusively with his strategists and with none of these other people who have a broader, more human-centered position. And I think that's harmful for him and for us.
Have you been watching a lot of television?
I have been, as have many other Americans. I watch it partly out of fascination with what's happening, partly out of being deeply upset with what's happening, and partly as somebody who wants to make sense of all this, to bring whatever professional experience and knowledge I have to some kind of interpretation of all this. It adds up to watching a lot of television.
Do you find yourself experiencing both involvement and a sense of helplessness as you watch TV?
Yes.
You're there, but there's nothing you can do.
The involvement is very important because, again, more than any other war, you're right there, you're in Kuwait, and you're riding on that missile or bomb as you see on the screen its precise targeting. In fact, psychologically speaking, one may become that missile or that bomb, because the missile or the bomb seems to substitute for the heroic warriors of the past. So we are much more involved. That can be a source of excitement, being involved that way in a war, because war has dramatic elements, dramatic life and death issues. But the irony is that we have some of the life and death excitement without being exposed to any danger of death as we sit in our living rooms and watch all this on a television screen. And again, I think this is unhealthy for us morally and psychologically.
Why is it unhealthy morally and psychologically?
It causes a kind of dissociation in the mind. Dissociation very simply means the separating off or segmenting off or splitting of one part of the self from the rest of the self. In this case, it's a kind of splitting of knowledge and feeling. We know that our weapons kill people at the other end, but we don't feel, we don't experience any of that pain or death. That is also a form of psychic numbing, or psychic numbing is a form of dissociation. And with our diminished inclination to feel and our remaining in this mild but very significant degree of dissociation, we lose our moral imagination, our ethical principles. Really, we lose perspective about values, about what it's worth doing and what it might not be worth doing in connection with war or in connection with holding back a person like Saddam Hussein and his Iraqi regime.
Psychologist Robert J. Lifton is my guest. He studied and written about the effects of war on the human psyche. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Robert J. Lifton is my guest, and he's written many books on the psychological effects of nuclear weapons. He's written about prisoners of war, war veterans, survivors, mass killing, Nazi doctors. And we're discussing his insights into the psychological effects of living with this war. Robert Lifton, do you object to the names that we've given all of our high-tech weapons, like the Patriot?
I suppose those names are inevitable. I do object to them nonetheless because, you know, the Patriot, I think, is a more commendable weapon in that it saves lives rather than killing people. But by and large, we tend to give our destructive weapons all kinds of mythic names, heroic names, names that would make them seem admirable when they really are a form of technology of destruction. And I think we do well, even in the case of the Patriot, which has become the high-tech hero of this war in many ways, I think we do well not to embrace it too passionately as an answer to all threats or problems. Any weapon or any means of intercepting weapons, such as the Patriot missile, can be overcome by other more advanced weapons in some not too distant future.
Well, let's face it, I think, you know, the Pentagon, the White House, they don't want to use language that is going to, among other things, keep up morale both on the home front and on the front lines. And you want to use language that's going to bring home the horrors of war. I don't think the two are very compatible.
Well, I think that I guess there's a difference in what the great danger is. Maybe to the Pentagon people, the danger is Americans learning the truth about war and therefore turning against the war. My sense of the danger is that of doing extensive killing in war without feeling any of that killing, without feeling any of that death. And that's a great danger to us as Americans. After all, throughout our history, we've prided ourselves on fighting only in situations where we're attacked, of fighting only for our own defense, of never attacking people who are innocent. And I don't think any of those things are clearly the case in regard to this war. And I don't think that the distancing brought about by the high-tech weapons, the television coverage, and the limitations that the Pentagon wants to impose, I don't think that we have any access to the truth about this war.
This is the first war that the United States has been involved with in which the use of chemical weapons is a threat both to us and to our allies. What new psychological dimensions do you think the threat of chemical weapons is adding?
I think that the threat of chemical weapons is something very special. One can say that logically, if you're killed by an ordinary missile, it's no better or worse than being killed by a missile that has a chemical warhead. But I think there is a dread of chemical weapons that has to do with some kind of what I call invisible contamination, with something that seems more outside the ordinary in its grotesque quality, that can attack one's body without one's being aware of it and do more grotesque things to one than ordinary weapons. There's always been this dread of chemical weapons, and I think one sees this fear as one watches the Israeli scene and the scene in Saudi Arabia as the fear of chemical weapons exists, and with good reason, in connection with Saddam Hussein. It would also mean a breaking of a certain restraint or barrier on the part of Saddam Hussein. He's already done it in having used them, and he's not a man who seems to go by restrictions, so we know that he's perfectly capable of using them again.
You've done studies of survivors and combatants in several wars. I'm wondering if there's any studies of yours that you think particularly apply to what you're witnessing in the Gulf War.
Well, certainly the work I did on prisoners of war, American prisoners of war returning from Chinese captivity in North Korea, certainly applies to these POWs. I think that the work I've done on nuclear weapons applies to the psychology of high-tech warfare, the psychology of being distanced, which is the psychology of dissociation and numbing that inevitably accompanies high-tech warfare. I think that the work I did on Nazi doctors applies, and earlier work I did on totalism, absolutism, the work on Nazi doctors follows on that too, applies to absolute positions of someone like Saddam Hussein, who is certainly an absolutist and a ruthless person, but also can apply to certain absolute inflexible positions that we have been taking and that President Bush has been taking in the United States. Some of my work on the contemporary self, the psychology of flexibility as opposed to the psychology of rigidity, also applies to this war, because I do think that President Bush and Saddam Hussein have gotten locked into a personal struggle in which I fear that President Bush inadvertently has given Saddam Hussein more world status by such an intense focus upon his person, really a kind of obsession with him, as you can recognize in the president's speeches, during which, particularly the speech announcing the beginning of the war, during which he mentioned Saddam Hussein's name, oh, more than 10 times, I believe. And I think that is harmful to the president's balanced capacity to deal with a very difficult and ruthless person in the best way possible. In this case, the psychology of a totalistic, absolutistic, ruthless person like Saddam Hussein is best handled quietly by stern measures such as sanctions and perhaps stepping them up further, blockading, really tough measures, but quietly applied rather than with challenges, because the psychology of this kind of person tells us that he's likely to respond to challenges with an absolutist position and wouldn't mind becoming a martyr or martyring very large numbers of his own people into the bargain.
Psychologist Robert J. Lifton is my guest. He studied and written about the effects of war on the human psyche. More with Lifton in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Robert J. Lifton is my guest, and for many years he's been studying the psychological effects of living with nuclear weapons, psychological after effects of being a prisoner of war. He studied war veterans, survivors, mass killings, Nazi doctors. And we're inviting him today to talk with us about the psychological effects of this war so far. Do you think that war requires dehumanizing the enemy, and do you see that happening now?
It does, and I do see it happening. What's sad is that Saddam Hussein is sufficiently ruthless and has done murderous things to a sufficient extent that he lends himself very easily to dehumanizing and to demonizing. He is a human being who has done some very evil things. But he is not the single embodiment of evil as we've tried to make him. There has been the image, people would deny it, but the feeling, if we only got rid of him, all problems in Iraq, in the Middle East, and virtually in the world would disappear, would end, because in combating him, we combat evil. Well, it doesn't work that way. That's the process of dehumanization and demonization, and it really serves us badly. There was an article in the New York Times that described a Marine corporal who was reading books to try to understand his situation, and he was reading Moby Dick, and he said by reading Moby Dick, he could understand how Saddam Hussein gets obsessed in the way that Captain Ahab did with the white whale. But I think that the Moby Dick model also applies to Americans and, sadly, to President Bush, who has become obsessed with Saddam Hussein as the embodiment of evil, as did Captain Ahab with the white whale as the embodiment of evil, and has focused his energy on destroying that white whale. That kind of dehumanization interferes with the capacity to recognize that there are ordinary human beings all through the Middle East and in Iraq and in Israel, human beings who want to live. And we have to think carefully and reflectively what policy on our part would help for future harmony and peace in the Middle East.
Would you make the same argument about Hitler, you know, about not dehumanizing him? I mean, here's a man who orchestrated the you know, the mass murder of millions of people.
Yes, I would make the same argument in the sense that, for instance, I never studied Hitler directly. I read a lot about him, but I did study Nazi doctors, mm-hmm. and people would say to me, well, look, they're not humans, they're demons. And I would say, no, the problem is they are humans. They are human beings who have done evil things. And my concern there in that study was with the psychological and historical forces or tendencies that are conducive to evil. So really pressing psychological and historical inquiry in that sense, and yet maintaining a moral position about evil. And I would have the same model for studying Hitler or Nazi doctors, Saddam Hussein or anything else. But I think it's very important to remember that these are human beings and that there's something in us that has some connection with these people, and that at our worst moments, we're able to do some of the things that they do. Not many of us are Saddam Husseins or Hitlers or Nazi doctors, but they are or were human beings. We, like them, have the potential for evil, and they don't embody all the evil in the world. We're capable of it also.
What is your version of normal life during this war? How is your life changing living in the presence of a new war that your country is fighting?
Well, speaking personally, it's changed dramatically and in a way that I haven't been happy with. I've had to stop doing my ordinary work. I'll have to go back and do some more preparation for the course I'm giving. The course is on the protean self, and it's on all those wonderful possibilities of the self with lots of exciting use of literary examples. But I've had to leave that and focus on some of the less attractive elements that I've been talking about, the distancing from killing and the questions of dissociation and numbing and the like. I've had to spend most of every day and evening in connection with something emanating from this war, and that has included doing a lot of media appearances, a lot of discussions, talking to a lot of friends. I just haven't felt free from the war. I've also felt the need not to be obsessed by the war, that is, to have some ordinary life. I have a wife and family, and it matters to me to have some recreation. I'm an avid tennis player. I try very hard to keep that up. But it's not so easy for me to maintain a normal life, and I try to tread an uneasy line between being responsible to problems raised by the war that I feel I can and should address on the one hand, and trying to maintain my own balance and some modicum of normality in my life pattern on the other.
Psychologist Robert J. Lifton, his book about the effects of nuclear weapons on the mind is called Indefensible Weapons.